percentage drop from that fall population to the spring population in our radio collared wolf packs is now at 43%.
A dispute between state and federal wildlife managers over wolves in the eastern interior. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 26th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the quiet controversy over the Donlin Creek gold mine proposal.
So what you get at the end is like a dictatorship of silence where people, you know, behind the scenes are against it, but when you go to a public meeting, you can't really speak against it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
State and federal wildlife managers are at odds over wolves in the eastern interior. The feds are concerned about a declining wolf population in Yukon Charley River's National Preserve, while the state is shooting wolves outside the conservation unit to bump up moose and caribou numbers in the broader area. Alaska Department of Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says it's a matter of dueling mandates.
We have different marching orders. The Park Service's mandates pertain to Yukon Charley and involve natural populations. Our mandate is to manage state lands and private lands for consumptive use by humans. And the boundaries between those areas are the challenges.
The state is trying to whittle down wolf numbers in a sprawling area that borders the Yukon Charley Preserve to improve caribou and moose hunting opportunities. The state's objective is to trim the much larger area's estimated 290 wolves to 60-85%. Harm says studies show the reduction will allow prey species to grow without endangering wolves.
In terms of the state's responsibilities, it would not be a biological concern. Wolves are a very, very, very productive species, and having a year or several years with a low number of wolves does not threaten the long-term welfare of wolf populations in that part of Alaska.
The National Park Service has a different take on the situation. Yukon Charley Superintendent Greg Dudgeon is concerned about a steep decline in preserve wolves this winter.
We know that the average pack size of the radio-collared wolves in the preserve has dropped from 5.8 in the fall of 2009 to 3.3 in the spring here in 2010. And the percentage drop from that fall population to the spring population in our radio-collared wolf packs is now at 43%.
Dudgeon says the decline to 26 wolves is the biggest drop the agency has observed since 1993. The situation was made worse recently when four preserve wolves were accidentally shot in a state fish and game aerial predator control hunt. The Park Service can't stop the state harvest, and its mandate includes protection of subsistence wolf hunting and trapping. But Dudgeon says he's considering closing the sport take of wolves.
The general or sport trapping season goes through the end of April, and the general or sport hunting season goes through the end of May. And our concern is that with the amount of time still left, that the additional loss of wolves would get us even further away from normal than where we are now.
Dudgeon says he's taking into account feedback from a public meeting March 22nd held in Eagle, which lies just outside the preserve boundary. Eagle Mayor Bo Fay says most area residents support wolf control and don't want the sport harvest shut down. Fay says the Park Service is playing politics with its wolf science.
They've been collaring wolves that aren't even in the preserve. And then when they come up with this figure, 26 wolves in the preserve, it would seem to me that they probably did their count on a day when there was only maybe two of the packs within the boundaries of the preserve on that particular day. And then that way they could come up with a low figure.
The Park Service's Dudgeon says only wolves that have a den or have home ranges in the preserve are counted, and the packs are radio tracked whether they are in or outside the preserve. Two of the wolves accidentally shot by Fish and Game had radio collars identifying them as preserve animals. Faye says he has inside information that the Park Service did not give Fish and Game the frequency for the wolf pack mistakenly killed by Fish and Game.
As far as I've been told by the pilot that was handling the receiver that the Park Service gave him, he was only given six frequencies. And in actuality, there were seven packs out there.
Faye accuses the Park Service of intentionally sacrificing the pack to make the state look bad. But the Park Service's Dudgeon discounts the accusations, saying the state had everything it needed to avoid preserve wolves.
At a meeting in Fairbanks on the 11th of March, we provided a complete flight sheet to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. It included all the frequencies of all the wolves that the National Park Service had radio collars on in the preserve. Along with that flight sheet accompanied the NPS radio collar frequency receiver that would be used to pick up those frequencies. It was in good working order.
Dudgeon says he's continuing to work with the state to figure out what went wrong and ensure no additional preserve wolves are shot in future control efforts. Fish and Game plans to release a report on what happened next week. The state may resume its aerial wolf kill in the control area around the Yukon Charley Preserve if there's fresh snow to allow tracking. Governor Sean Parnell announced terms of his cruise ship head tax cut legislation yesterday. The bill includes a corporate income tax credit for cruise lines contributing to the state's tourism marketing campaign. The governor is introducing his own measure rather than trying to amend an existing tax credit bill that's met opposition. But combining the measure remains an option. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Parnell wants to reduce the passenger fee from $46 to $34.50 per person. In announcing his bill, he said the cut would come from eliminating what's called the Regional Impact Fund.
That's the one that's been in dispute in the litigation. It's the one with that creates the questionable appropriations, that creates the exposure for the state in the litigation. So my intention is to clean that up, resolve the litigation, and bring jobs and business back to our Alaska small businesses.
The cruise industry sued the state last fall, claiming head tax revenues were used for projects that did not directly impact ships, as is required by law. Attorney General Dan Sullivan said the state had a strong case and would fight the lawsuit. Parnell would not discuss specifics of the case, but he said he wanted the lawsuit ended. Cruise lines say they'll do that if the legislation passes.
As a lawyer who's practiced in the state, private practice for about 13 years of the last 22, anytime you're in litigation, there are chances of exposure and liability.
Parnell presented his tax cut plan recently to cruise line executives at a Miami trade show. They included companies that have pulled three ships out of the Alaska market this summer, reducing passenger numbers by about 15%. One line agreed to delay its 2012 schedule decisions until the legislature considers the bill. Parnell says he hopes the others will do the same, but he admitted he had no firm commitment that any of the ships would return.
I made a very pointed case that they would need to demonstrate that in the public process, that this would bring back ships, that it would create Alaska jobs, and not just be a transfer of dollars from the state to their bottom line.
Parnell's bill would further reduce fees for passengers on ships that stop in Juneau and Ketchikan, which charge their own head taxes. That could reduce the state tax to $19.50, a 60% cut. Backers of the initiative that created the tax, including Gershon Cohen of Haines, say Parnell's bill is a giveaway to a highly profitable industry.
It is really unfortunate that Governor Parnell feels so compelled to pander to the industry. The effects of the head tax on passenger totals, as claimed by the industry, are simply not supported by the facts. The passengers pay the head tax, not the cruise lines, who are still making billions of dollars in profits. And so when you look at the amount of money they pay for a cruise, the $50 is just simply immaterial. In fact, most of them don't even know they're being charged.
Alaska tour business owners are expected to lobby heavily for the bill's passage. Parnell says cruise line officials also committed to testifying about their support. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Lower Yukon fishermen hope changing out their nets will stop state limitations.
We feel if we go to 7.5 inch that there should be no further restrictions on the subsistence fishery.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The proposed Pebble Creek mine gets a lot of attention from environmental activists and native groups who want to make sure it never happens. But another massive gold mine in development a few hundred miles away called Donlin Creek has gone largely unnoticed by anyone outside the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. But that doesn't mean it isn't controversial. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
On a bitter winter day in Aniak, the gray and white landscape surrounding the village looks barren, but evidence of the abundance of a different season is tucked away in D. Matter's freezers. The Aniak elder has three of the extra-large variety parked under a lean-to next to her house.
This is my salmon, pretty much my salmon. I keep my dried fish in here, my half-dried gamakluk fish. It's partially dried and then frozen. And then we just boil it and eat it. And heads and tails and...
And that's just one of her freezers. The others hold beaver, spruce chicken, caribou, and even a few fruitcakes. Inside her cozy cabin, Matter warms up with a cup of tea and then starts talking about a subject that troubles her, the Donlin Creek mine. She worries the project could put her subsistence life at risk.
In one way, I hate to see what we have be jeopardized by gold. Money.
The proposed gold mine site is about 60 miles from Aniak. It would be an open pit mine, 2 miles wide. The company that owns Donlin Creek, Barrick Nova Gold, expects it to produce at least 30 million ounces of gold over 20 years. Matter knows it would provide desperately needed jobs for the region. She's clearly torn over the issue, but wishes there was a better option.
If there's a leak and it goes into the streams and then it goes into the Kuskokwim River, we would lose so much, you know. So when I look at it from that point of view, then it doesn't sound so very good for only 20 years.
The environmental concerns regarding Donlin Creek are not small. The current plan calls for barging in diesel fuel to power the mine, exponentially increasing barge traffic on the Kuskokwim River. The land the mine sits on contains high levels of mercury that could be released into the atmosphere as the ore is processed on site. There's also the potential for something called acid rock drainage, where the mine exposes a mineral that could seep into the watershed, altering the river ecosystem.
I wouldn't be working for this company if I didn't think they were going to do it right.
That's former state representative Mary Sattler Nelson. The Bethel resident is now the community development manager for Donlin Creek. She says the company understands the environmental concerns and takes them very seriously. Donlin Creek reports its local hire rate at over 90%. And Sattler Nelson says that means people who care about the local environment are keeping a close watch on the mine.
When you go to the camp, almost everybody is from the region. And we've been stewards of our region for a long time now.
But David Grizzo worries there isn't currently enough technical expertise in the region to monitor the complicated mining process. Grizzo used to be executive director of the Kuskokwim River Watershed Council, based in Aniak. He left the job to return to his home country, Spain, earlier this month. Grizzo has a background in mining engineering and says even a small mishap at the site could have big consequences.
You just need one accident to wipe out maybe a lot of the native salmon population here, and so there can be, it can change completely the landscape, the social, economic way of life in the region in the next 10, 15 years.
Grizzo is puzzled the Donlin Creek project hasn't had the same statewide attention as the proposed Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay. Privately, environmental groups say they have huge concerns about the mine, but wouldn't go on record for this story. They've shied away from becoming publicly involved in the Donlin project, partly because it's on Native-owned land instead of state land, and has more local support than Pebble. Grizzo worries that lack of outside interest has had a chilling effect on the debate over the mine, and he says within the region, Donlin Creek promoters haven't welcomed an open dialogue.
So what you get at the end is like a dictatorship of silence where people, you know, behind the scenes are against it, but when you go to a public meeting, you can't really speak against it. And if you do, other people will immediately tell you to not stir emotions or go against the mine. So opposing the project means here that you're going to get a lot of pressure from different sides to shut up.
But Donlin Creek does have strong support in the area. Upriver from Aniak, the tiny community of Crooked Creek is overwhelmingly in favor of the project. Just 13 miles from the proposed site, the village would become a staging area for the mine. Resident Dennis Thomas says the exploration jobs at the site have already transformed the community.
And when these people are working, you see them walking down the street, they're walking tall. You know what I'm saying? And you could just tell the difference. These people got a job. They're responsible. So it just goes to show you what we need are some job back there.
Donlin Creek Community Development Manager Mary Sattler-Nelson says the jobs don't just provide a good paycheck. They offer a whole new way of life.
Every culture puts a high value on your providers. And a lot of the people who work on our project hunt more. They fish more. They're providers. And that is really a hard thing to quantify, but you can see it and you can feel it.
Whether the mine will ever be in operation is far from a sure thing. Donlin Creek had expected to begin the permitting process last year. Sattler-Nelson says rising fuel costs now have the company reconsidering its plan to power the mine. She says there's no timeline for moving forward with Donlin Creek, and there will only be a skeleton crew on site this summer. For APRN, I'm Annie Feit.
A coastal development program says it will foot the bill so lower Yukon fishermen can comply with new restrictions. The Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association is buying webbing and net materials for fishermen near the mouth of the river. The CDQ hopes a new fleet of nets will persuade the state of Alaska to be less restrictive during the upcoming salmon runs. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
The purchase is meant to help Yukon coastal communities cope with new mesh size restrictions. The State Board of Fisheries outlawed nets with mesh sizes larger than 7.5 inches. That move was intended to force the conservation of depleted stocks of large Yukon king salmon by banning larger mesh gear. The law doesn't go in effect until 2011, but Yukon Fisheries Association CEO Regner Ahlstrom says their commercial outfit is getting ready now.
Why wait for 2 years? Why wait for 2011? Let's start this summer.
New drift nets can cost up to $1,500. That expense was a large reason Yukon fishers have for years resisted any mesh restrictions. The region has been declared a fisheries disaster by the federal government, and Ahlstrom says most fishers would have a difficult time coming up with money for new gear. YDFDA is the Community Development Quota Program operating on the Lower Yukon and one of just two buyers on the river. Ahlstrom says over the next 2 years, they hope to distribute 1,000 nets, starting with commercial permit holders this year.
There's about 500 active commercial fishermen. So the goal is to get a net into a commercial fisherman's hand. And then if you have a person or head of family that does not have a commercial permit in the family, then that we'd get a net to the head of that subsistence family.
The Department of Fish and Game says that smaller mesh nets should allow more kings to make it to their spawning grounds. That will mean less kings in drying racks and freezers. Ahlstrom hopes that by making this conservation sacrifice, the state will not close down the commercial and subsistence fisheries like they did for weeks last year.
We feel if we go to 7.5 inch that there should be no further restrictions on the subsistence fishery so that folks can get their subsistence needs met early in the season when the drying weather is good.
The value of those nets is estimated at about $1.5 million. Ahlstrom says that's worth it if it can help avoid the fisheries disasters of the last 2 years on the Yukon.
It's a small fishery. They're only going to make a couple thousand dollars, but a couple thousand dollars is a lot when you're not making anything.
In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Former Kuskokwim 300 race manager Stacy Gilliland was sentenced in court yesterday. The sentence came after Gilliland pleaded guilty to felony theft and struck a deal with state prosecutors. The sentencing hearing was presided over by Judge Marvin Hamilton. Hamilton accepted the deal, which calls for Gilliland to serve 2 years probation and pay restitution to the K300 in the amount of $7,500. Gilliland will not serve jail time. As sentencing began, debate revolved around whether or not Gilliland would have to apologize for the crime she pleaded guilty to. Judge Hamilton pointed out that Gilliland admitted her guilt. He said an apology would be a big deal to you and the community, and a letter of apology is essential and would do more to heal the wounds of this case. Hamilton said that Gilliland had 30 days to write a letter to the K300 organization. He did not detail what content had to be in that apology, and he did not mandate that it be posted publicly. Gilliland is now a convicted felon and will remain so until she completes her 2-year probation. But she received what's called a suspended imposition of sentence, which effectively means she was not sentenced and never will be if she completes probation. Once her probation is up, her record will be clean. Gilliland was also ordered to pay $1,000 in restitution to a trust she managed for a juvenile.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
The Alaska Marine Highway System is bringing online service back aboard. State officials signed a contract this month to provide internet connections to most ferries when they're at sea. The $2.2 million contract with Radio Holland covers almost 3 years. Ferry Chief Jim Beadle says staff will try the system out as a communications and administrative tool before it goes public.
Basically, it's going to be internal. We need to make sure that it works for the Alaska Marine Highway System, and then we hope to broaden it out and allow the public to connect to use cell phones or laptop computers and stuff.
The system is already on most ferries. The Lakanti and Taku will get the equipment this year. The Marine Highway tried providing onboard online service before, but it didn't work out.
Because of our tall mountains, because of the location that we're in, where you use satellite connection and people that were hooked up were having large problems with it, so we stopped charging. We would probably just provide it as a service until we know that the service is reliable enough that you can charge money for it.
The new system is expected to overcome those problems. It will be set up as a private network, like one Radio Holland built for a 55-vessel fleet operating on the St. Lawrence Seaway. While the system will be free once it's public, Beadle says it could eventually switch to a pay service. The Alaska Congressional Delegation has bills pending in both the Senate and House to allow 5 towns in Southeast to form Native Village Corporations. The towns of Haines, Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, and Tanaki were left out in 1971 when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed, but Juneau and Sitka were included. It's not the first time Alaska Congress members have introduced bills to allow the towns to select federal lands. The bills have failed to pass because the issue is controversial. The land would have to come out of the Tongass National Forest. The landless village issue came up for discussion at the Wrangell Assembly, along with another bill, also controversial, to grant land selections in southern Southeast to the Sealaska Regional Native Corporation. Tony Gorman reports from member station KSTK.
The Wrangell Assembly voted unanimously Tuesday night to support the landless bill. The measure, sponsored by Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, would allow Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan, Haines, and Tenneke Springs natives to form village corporations and select land under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Myrna Torgamson spoke to the assembly on behalf of the Wrangell Cooperative Association. She believes Wrangell would still be a thriving timber town if it had been included in the act.
It's an injustice that was done to our people. I don't feel that we'd be in this horrible situation where there's no money for anything. When you see half of your community move out of here because there's no work, who do you have to thank for it? Well, shutting down the timber industry. That took all of the economy out of the southeastern Alaska.
Torkelson says there are 700 Sea Alaska shareholders enrolled to Wrangell. She says many are willing to come back home if the landless bill goes through. Torkelson also voiced support for a second piece of legislation, the Sea Alaska Land Selection Bill. Even though they are separate issues, she thinks the Sea Alaska bill could help the landless community's cause in the long run.
We asked that question and they told us if Sea Alaska bill does happen to go through, then it'll be a good thing for the landless.
Torkelson says she would get a resolution from the Cooperative Association to the Assembly as soon as possible. Mayor Don McConaughey says he would like to see that resolution on the agenda for the next Assembly meeting. George Woodbury of Woodbury Enterprises also talked to the Assembly about the Sea Alaska legislation. He says he realizes it will be an uphill battle.
Odds are against us with the administration. We got the template they've laid out for managing the forest. It's starting to see daylight, and it's a disaster as far as the timber supply is concerned.
The Sea Alaska Land Selection Bill has sparked controversy over the past few weeks throughout the region and nation. It would allow the Southeast Regional Native Corporation to select rich timberland on Prince of Wales Island and extend its logging operations. If it doesn't pass, Sea Alaska says its timber operations could disappear in 2 years. Reporting from Wrangell, I'm Tony Gorman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Tony Gorman in Wrangell. APRN's Annie Fight reported from Aniak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Pan Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at panair.com.
Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.